Hello, thank you for joining me for episode 8 of the Sleep to Healthy podcast titled Narcolepsy and Sleep Disorders. I'm your host, Dennis Trumpy, and my goal is to help improve your sleep for your better health and well-being. You may be trying to figure out how to sleep longer and better, but there's a segment of the population that has the opposite problem. They have trouble staying awake. To be clear, I am not talking about those who suffer from depression or other issues that might lead to extra long periods in bed. Those with narcolepsy have a specific neurological condition that leads to spontaneous sleep episodes, often at the most inopportune times, such as in the middle of a card game. Today, we are privileged to have Henry Nichols with us, author of Sleepyhead, The Neuroscience of a Good Night's Rest. Although the book is primarily about narcolepsy, as the title suggests, it also covers other sleep issues and disorders. Often in neuroscience, non-standard conditions can help us better understand how our brain works. Henry's journey to understand narcolepsy has led to understanding the issue of sleep and sleep orders in a broader context. In addition to writing the book from the objective viewpoint of a science journalist, Henry is narcolepsy himself and so provides an insider's perspective. Henry is a successful science journalist and a high school teacher, and writes news and features for the world's leading popular science media. Henry, welcome to this episode of the Sleep to Healthy podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Virtually every guest I have on this podcast has a story of overcoming adversity with their sleep struggles. Can you tell us your journey with your sleep issues?
So I'm now in my late 40s, and it's more than 20 years ago since I developed narcolepsy. So you touched on it there in your intro. It's a neurological disorder that involves a loss of certain neurons. We may get onto those and why they vanish, but it kind of hits usually in teenage years, but it can hit at any age, but most commonly in teenage. For me, I was 21 and at university, and I started getting very sleepy. And the problem there, I think, and in fact, it really happens for everyone with narcolepsy, you're somewhere quite often between normal and pathological, and you're really uncertain of whether anything really is the problem. And if you're somewhere like at university where you're staying up late in any case, partying quite hard, then there are lots of other reasons why you might be sleepy. And so it can often be very difficult to get a diagnosis because you just end up ruling it out. And I think for a long time, several months, I would be putting it down to other reasons until it became so strange that it was... I was asleep in lectures, so were several other students. So that's sort of what I mean. It kind of crosses over into normal a little bit. But I was asleep every single time, pretty much as soon as anyone started giving a lecture, slightly darkened room. It would just be a colossal weight on the mind. I'm completely unable to stay awake. It's not. It's a fight that you begin. You're trying to fight against it, but you lose every single time. So it is a complete compulsion to sleep. So that was really my introduction to it.
And what happened with that? Were you able to eventually have that diagnosed?
I was, and I. Only 18 months. I say only because that is extremely fast from the onset to diagnosis. just a year and a half. Extremely fast today, extremely fast for the 1990s, which is when it was hitting me. So back then, it would be really typical that the average delay for people with narcolepsy in the 1990s, average between the onset and diagnosis of symptoms, would be 10 to 15 years. So people were largely just living with narcolepsy and completely undiagnosed, not for want of trying, I'd hasten to add. Everyone with narcolepsy has a story of going to the doctors, presenting symptoms, and because they cross over into normal or non-pathological, the way the brain works, sometimes you do get sleepy. This is the response you get from your GP or primary care physician, or you. This was typical. Things are changing, and the awareness of narcolepsy and the symptoms and how they manifest and how they actually are really quite different from normal sleepiness is becoming, it's improving. So 18 months is all it took for me to get diagnosed. At that point, I still had very little idea of what the impact this would have on my life would be. I got some medication, which helped with some of the symptoms, and not very much with the sleepiness. There are a bunch of other symptoms that we will get onto, perhaps. Not so much with the sleepiness. And I sort of muddled on for 20 years or so until I decided, and I was by then a journalist and freelancing, so working from home, which is tends to be where people with narcolepsy end up, or quite a lot of the time. Or, in fact, I should broaden it there. People with sleep disorders or dysfunctional sleep of any kind. It is. I have seen and recognized a similarity or a similar pattern that happens, that people, and the reason is simple, people struggle to operate in the world that people with healthy sleep operate in. They can do stuff that people with dysfunctional sleep really, really find hard. And so operating in that world and in those social settings is difficult, awkward, embarrassing quite often. And under those circumstances, you kind of end up being isolated. Anyway, that's an aside. I was working as a writer. I'd written several books, and then I decided to tackle sleep. And I thought, I can write about sleep because I'll do it coming from the point of view of narcolepsy. I'll write about narcolepsy and other sleep disorders. And I had the book proposal was a bit outrageous. And usually when you put together an outrageous book proposal, you think, well, God, I'm not really sure if this works. Is this as a kind of plot? But the plot was, I understand narcolepsy. I can write a book about narcolepsy. But that's just, there's not that many people with narcolepsy. It's a smaller appeal. Can I write a book about all sleep disorders? And more importantly, because yes, I could do that, I was proposing that I would find connections between narcolepsy and all other sleep disorders, and be able to use narcolepsy to link them all together into a book that really just looked at the bigger landscape of dysfunctional sleep and the brain. But narcolepsy was my way in, and actually I was arguing the way in to study sleep disorders, because the pathology that underlies narcolepsy is bang central to the way the brain controls sleep. and what happens in narcolepsy when that goes out touches then on all other sleep disorders, however those come about. So insomnia probably has a different neurological basis. Sleep apnea and the breathing disorders, they clearly have a different, there's a mechanical basis to those, not so much neurological. But because they're all touching on sleep, narcolepsy is there at the heart. And I'm completely sold on my own idea now. Having written the book, I found those connections and they were much more profound and significant than I imagined when I put together the 3-page pitch. And that realization, that broadening out from narcolepsy, really informed my own understanding of sleep and my own understanding of narcolepsy and led me to a place that improved my sleep, which is not something I imagined would happen with the book. But there we go. That's what happens, I think, if you find out about stuff, if you learn things, and really get to grips with the subject, you find new stuff. And I mean, that is definitely the most rewarding thing about writing books and all education. I'm kind of sold on education a bit now, starting a new career as a teacher.
Well, okay. So I'd like to have one more kind of personal question before we get on to the broader topic of narcolepsy and the sleep disorders. And that is, at the beginning of the book, I think, you write that you have a newfound ability to function and sleep well that from writing the book. And so I'm wondering, how did working on this topic lead to this revelation?
So this is kind of what I'm saying, and just to sort of elaborate and unpick that, I was anxious about the chapter on insomnia and several other chapters that I perceived when I began I would struggle to have authority on. How can someone with narcolepsy, a sleep disorder where we're told there is a lot of sleep, too much sleep, it's talk, write with authority about insomnia, what appears to be precisely the opposite? So, you know, I'm a journalist, I can learn about and interview and find out about insomnia, but where would that connection be? And it turns out this was perhaps one of the easiest chapters to write. As soon as I began to see narcolepsy, not so much as a hypersomnia, which is how it's categorized, hyper, so excessive, a disorder of excessive sleep. There is a lot of sleep, and it comes often and at annoying times, and it's uncontrollable. But if you tot it up, it's not much more in duration than we're supposed to be getting. And what it is completely dysfunctional sleep. Its quality, its quantity may be the same or slightly more than normal. The quality of sleep of a person with narcolepsy it doesn't exist. It is like then being awake the whole time. And in fact, when I went back and found the very first descriptions of narcolepsy, which are from the 19th century, it's the first sleep disorder described, in fact, in medicine. And this patient, it was a case study. So the patient being described by this German physician, he describes all the sleepiness, but also and lots of the other symptoms, which we will get onto. But one of the symptoms that he talked about was broken sleep, fractured nighttime sleep, actual periods of insomnia. And that, though he mentioned it in 1877, I think, it really took until the last 10 or 15 years for the sleep specialists to really appreciate that broken nighttime sleep is one of the six big symptoms of narcolepsy, and there's loads of other stuff too that goes wrong when these neurons go out the window. So I do not sleep. I have much more in common with someone with insomnia than I possibly imagined. So rather than being opposite side, well, we're kind of opposite. Our opposites, we're just opposite sides of the same coin. And when I went to, I got sent by my consultant to try and do something about my insomnia, the broken sleep. I was sent on a course of cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. I was in a room with insomniacs, a little bit anxious about that, but they were great. Very interested to have a narcoleptic, someone with narcolepsy in the room. And I learned their techniques on how to break insomnia, and they were extremely helpful for me. And that was one of several realizations that actually my poor sleep was largely narcolepsy, but not all narcolepsy. I'd spent 20 years just writing off sleep as something I could do nothing about, ignoring the unbelievably obvious truth that I'm a human and could be beyond being a narcoleptic human, and I could also have insomnia or snore or have sleep apnea, other sleep disorders that I could do something about. So then it became that led me to a much better sleep. Not anywhere near normal, but so much better. There were things that I could control that I'd been ignoring. And I think that message is probably, and the message about learning, if we learn and we understand about sleep and we're able to spot those patterns, there's a huge amount we can do to improve our sleep. But it requires an investment. Sleep is, improving sleep is juggling a whole load of balls, keeping them in the air all simultaneously. You can work on one thing, you might not notice the differences. You're trying to do everything to achieve that really good sleep.
If you're enjoying and benefiting from the Sleep to Healthy podcast, why not share the good news? When I ask, most people I talk to have one or more sleep issues, and they usually like talking about it. Why not give them the gift of feeling and functioning better, especially when it doesn't cost you a dime? Some people still haven't caught on to podcasts yet. If you really want to do them a favor, offer to take their phone, download a podcast app for them, and subscribe to the Sleep to Healthy podcast to get them started. That's a double favor. Better sleeps and entering the wonderful world of podcasts. Who knows? It might even lead to a date. So you've mentioned a couple of times that narcolepsy is a, I can't remember how you said it, but there's a specific neurological something missing, or brain cells that have changed or have disappeared. Can you explain a little bit about that and maybe how that ties into why it is so central to other sleeping disorders?
These cells, and there really aren't very many of them because the brain is, 100 billion cells? Is that right? I'm going to have to check that. I might be wrong. So these cells are in the hypothalamus, which is a small part of the brain, right in the middle of the brain. And they're a tiny fraction. They occupy a tiny fraction of the hypothalamus. And we didn't know of their existence. There are only about 30, 40, 50,000 of them in the human brain. We did not know of their existence. And we did not know of the chemical that they make and secrete that is received on the other side of these neural connections, or what it did. We were just carrying on working on all the other neurotransmitters that we understood. This, though, turns out to be one of the most important orchestrating systems for the entire brain. It is controlling so many things, and the most obvious is alertness of the entire brain. Just, it's almost like the message to wake up starts in these cells when they release their neurotransmitter. So it's called hypocretin or orexin. It goes by two names, unfortunately. And it was discovered 20 years ago. And it was discovered independently of narcolepsy, but very soon, within a year of the identification of this new protein that people hadn't recognized in the brain before, they identified, scientists in America, Stanford, had linked it to narcolepsy. And those cells go. And that pretty much is what underlies narcolepsy. And understanding that explains a lot about narcolepsy and why its symptoms and the consequences for functioning as a human become so challenging. Or it's so, life is so challenging without those neurons. The most common, there are lots of ways those neurons can go. So it's a kind of brain damage or neurodegeneration, but it is contained to those cells. They've gone. And it's largely because it's, for most people, by far, you know, the majority of people with narcolepsy, it's an autoimmune attack, which means that your own immune system went round attacking a virus, probably, a bacteria, possibly in some situations, developing antibodies against this alien invader. And for some people, and there are a whole bunch of conditions that need to be met, there's a little bit of a genetic component, but not much, and there are probably some stresses from the environment at a certain time. There may be something that happens when you're developing. For some people, those antibodies, they go around and they wipe out. They read the cells in the brain, these cells in the brain, as if they were pathogenic, as if they were the microbe that the antibodies have been designed to take out. So they just wipe them out. And within the space of about a week, they're gone. So type 1 diabetes is, you know, certainly an autoimmune disorder, celiac disease, lots of other disorders. The immune system kind of goes rogue, not unreasonably, just it's unfortunate, it's unlucky. And there's a bunch of contingencies that are required and in place. But for most people with narcolepsy, it's just darn bad luck, an infection at a certain time, and they're gone. Without them, so the whole bunch of downstream neurological networks, which we now are getting to understand through some amazing science taking place all around the world, but there's huge interest in this hypocretin system because of its absolutely central position to the sort of really basic functions of the brain. But broadly speaking, its functions, I mean, divide into three zones. So one is the alertness function. When you wake up, it's going to switch on the whole brain, and it's responsible for that. But it also plays into and moderates the way that neurons understand dopamine. So that's the motivation, addiction, motivation aspects. So without the hypocretin, all the neurons that respond to dopamine struggle a bit. It's very hard to be motivated in the way that just most people take for granted. And that plays really very strongly into the hands of the sleepiness. As soon as motivation goes, or your activity goes, or your enthusiasm for something, you're going to be doing nothing and then you fall asleep. And the third axis is the serotonin system, which is also moderated by hypocretin. So without hypocretin, your serotonin isn't doing what it should do. And this is then mood and depression sets in. So there's a whole bunch of downstream things that go that really spread narcolepsy much further than just simply wake and sleep. And the serotonin is probably also, the failure of the serotonin system or the weakness of it is probably also responsible for this incredible symptom that comes for a lot of people with narcolepsy called cataplexy. So in the absence of the sort of functioning serotonin axis, emotions, like a good giggle, just ripple down past the serotonin thing. They just clear straight through it and they kind of cause a paralysis. It's exactly the same state that our bodies enter into during dreaming sleep. So that pathway gets triggered by emotions. So I make a joke. I wasn't having an attack there, but just a little cough. I think I'm being really funny. And all of a sudden, all my muscles just start collapsing, starting in the mouth and then ripping. My head drops to my chest. My arms flop down. And if it's really funny, or if I, more to the point, if I think it's really funny, because it's very, very, very rarely funny. But if I think it's funny, that's all that matters. I'm on the ground and it's a full sort of Obi-Wan Kenobi type collapse, just straight down, which can be dangerous, obviously, depending on what you're doing. If you're at the top of the stairs, you do not want to be doing it. If you're holding a kettle, you do not want to be doing it. If you're crossing a road, you do not want to be having cataplexy. So I'm sort of making slightly light of it. And in my life, it's relatively a light thing. It's a positive. It's fun. It's when I'm laughing, I'm happy. But I don't have, everyone's triggers are different. I mean, everyone with narcolepsy experiences these symptoms in different ways. And there are multiple triggers. And laughter, mirth or happiness is easily the most common trigger for cataplexy. But there are others like anxiety or anger. I can have cataplexy if I get really angry, but I have to be really angry, really angry. And then I probably don't collapse. I just sort of, my head will fall to my chest in anger. Yeah, it's very highly effective. Actually, it is highly effective if I'm really telling my children off, like really telling my children off. They might not even listen, but if my head drops and I start to collapse, now they listen. Now they're quiet. It can be. It does have its upsides. So there were things like, even grief. All of those things are much less common emotions than the happiness, which is we're all having all the time, actually. And then cataplexy can be striking 20, 30, 40 times a day, and it's not just inconvenient, it becomes psychologically destructive. And, talking to a lot of people with narcolepsy, as I have done, this is really one of the nastiest things about narcolepsy. The sleepiness, you've got ways to manage that, but the unpredictability of being floored by emotions means that people find ways to stop having emotions. That is how they solve cataplexy. So you just cut out fun and anything unpredictable. That's not a good way to live.
People looking for a quality podcast often rely on reviews to make their listening decision. Help open the world to better health and well-being through improved sleep by leaving a review on your favorite podcast app or Apple Podcasts. If you're not sure how, just visit sleeptohealthy.com for help.
So, as you mentioned, you know, that narcolepsy is kind of the center, or certainly that all these, so many other sleeping disorders kind of radiate out from it. So what sleep disorders do you think people should be most aware of, and why?
I think because of the prevalence of them, you know, the big sleep disorders are the ones that, you know, just in terms of your listeners, the ones that are most relevant are going to be most likely to be out there, and people paying attention to, realizing they have, and then seeking treatment, are insomnia and sleep apnea. So, yeah, I suppose I'm answering your question in what I'm thinking is, if I've, you know, a couple of sentences, and how can I help the most people? That's the way, because these are the most common sleep disorders. And there's a lot of people out there with them. 10% of people have insomnia at any one time, chronic insomnia. And maybe 5%, as many as 5% of people, 1 in 20 people, will have sleep apnea to a degree which they, you know, everyone's probably gets it a little bit, but to a degree that actually warrants treatment. And I think a lot of, because there's so many people with these sleep disorders, and sleep has always been just something people take for granted, and I'm a case in point there. I just sort of ignored the significance of my terrible sleep for 20 years, whereas just a little bit of work and research and finding out I could have done stuff about it. I think there are a lot of people with insomnia who are just living with it, take it for granted. This is how I just have insomnia and there's nothing I can do. And if you think you have sleep apnea, you absolutely need to get it checked out and seen to and stopped. And I put extra emphasis on that because it's mainly the consequences for sleep apnea are, yes, it destroys sleep, and that's, you know, I can relate to all of that. But it puts enormous pressure on the heart, and so you die. It's pretty, you know, it's huge cardiovascular risk. Sleep apnea, I'm sure your listeners know, is, you know, you stop sleeping. You stop sleeping. You stop breathing, but the breathing stops you sleeping. But you stop breathing in the night for maybe 10, 20 seconds until you kind of wake up. So there's the broken sleep, and that's the same as narcolepsy, just waking up a lot. But in that non-breathing, the levels of carbon dioxide in your blood are rising. You're running out of oxygen. Your cells are beginning to, it's getting a bit panicky, screaming. It's like that feeling of being in a swimming pool, and you're running out of oxygen. You're asleep, so you never know this, but your body is, it's getting serious. And what happens in your lungs when there's no oxygen is, the bits with no oxygen just sort of, the capillaries, they shut down. And this is to reroute the blood to bits of the lung that might still have some oxygen. But that shutting down, which is a sensible, evolved bit of physiology, it's like putting put huge resistance in an electrical circuit, and the current backs up and to the heart, so you're putting putting the heart under pressure, like literal extreme pressure. So this is like extreme high blood pressure. For a moment, your heart starts racing, it's dealing with extremely high blood pressure. So all of that's very dangerous. So, yeah, those two. But the insomnia and sleep apnea are by far the most significant. And if you think you might have them, and you'll know if you have insomnia, and you probably know if you have sleep apnea. If you snore, you're at risk of it. If a bed partner, someone you know who's in your bed, has told you you stop sleeping, got to get it checked out. And so if you think you have insomnia, also look into it, get it checked out, because, well, there are medications, but by far the most effective treatment, and it is effective for a lot of people, is just having greater awareness of the things that brought them to that insomnia point. And cognitive behavioral therapy is just like 10 or 15 really clever tricks that you can use to break an insomnia. And you just learn these tricks.
Well, I'm glad you spent a bit of time in giving some details about sleep apnea, because we actually have not covered that yet in the podcast. And we're actually going to be covering the cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia in, I think, two episodes from now. So we'll cover that. And certainly apnea is a big enough issue that we will devote a episode, or probably more than one episode, to that sometime in the future. And you talked earlier on about how you got diagnosed relatively quickly, but other times it can take even decades before people get properly diagnosed. So if I'm somebody, I suspect I might have a sleeping disorder of some type, what would you suggest that I can do to kind of speed up that time to diagnosis, proper diagnosis?
Yeah, that's a tricky question, because it depends on, excuse me, that's a tricky question because it depends on the medical profession really getting up to speed about the significance of sleep. Yes, for people with sleep disorders, but actually much more profoundly for health, for the entire for our entire existence. Wakefulness is predicated, like the functioning, effective wakefulness is predicated on, it assumes, good sleep. There is not one medical condition of all the thousands that doctors deal with every day that would not be improved by improving sleep. And so, I don't know, if you're a surgeon and you're operating on the intestine, sleep is way out of your picture, but it will be an important part of it. It could have contributed to whatever it is that you're operating on, but it will definitely contribute. Good sleep will contribute to the recovery of the patient after the operation, but they're not going to pay attention to that. So you think you have a sleep disorder, and you go to your doctor, you're very likely, I think, still unfortunately in 2019, to be bounced away. There are too many explanations for poor sleep that do not involve pathology, as far as a doctor's concerned, that aren't genuine sleep disorders. So, I kind of get it from... the most obvious explanation is just something else. So what it means is, if you think you have, you're really going to have to push, and you're going to have to learn a lot yourself. And there are lots of things you can do on your own. So if you've got insomnia, well, you can just find out about that stuff. You can read. There are some great books on it that will teach you all the methods. So you don't actually have to go on one of these courses, and your doctor doesn't actually have to be involved, but it will be probably a bit more effective for some people going on an actual course. But the bottom line is, you're going to have to push. You may need to see a doctor several times, different doctor, to get where you need to. But you're probably going to help them, which means if you think you might have narcolepsy, you're going to have to give them what they need and show them that you are ticking the boxes and you've got, I've got cataplexy. They won't have heard of cataplexy, or many of them won't. And so you can show them, you can video yourself, you take this information. You record yourself sleeping. There are apps that will record you snoring, and you can take that and show that you have sleep apnea and it's happening this often. So you have to do quite a bit of the grunt work, I think, yourself, but that means understanding sleep and what you're talking about. So you obviously need to read a really comprehensive book about sleep disorders. You need to just find out about sleep, see if you can work out what it is, and take that to the doctors and keep pushing.
So it sounds to me like what you're saying, the keys are to be educated, to be persistent, and also to, you know, be willing to gather and present that information to the doctors. And you say in the book that there, if I remember this correctly, that there are two tests that underpin the diagnosis of most sleep disorders, and that's the overnight sleep study and the multiple sleep latency test. So can you explain what those are and how the results are used?
Yeah. So the overnight sleep study, this is essentially a bunch of sleep specialists watching you, recording you, measuring your brain waves while you sleep. So you have to go in to a lab or the hospital, and they wire your brain up 20 or so electrodes across your scalp, and then you've got a little room. And they say it's just send you to sleep. So they're not watching, I suppose, but the computers are then recording and monitoring the little electrical pulses that ripple out from the brain, conducted across the skull, and that we can't feel them, but they're there. And it's called electroencephalogram, picks up these little waves, and it can tell. Now, we've worked this out the 1930s onwards, but there are really clear patterns to these little superficial electrical pulses throughout the night. So the brain is going through, is doing stuff, first of all. This is not an idle neurological state. It's doing really important things that we're now beginning to understand. But back in the 20th century, really what it was to try and describe what sleep looks like. We can't get into the middle of the brain to study it. So we're looking at this echo coming out. It's not telling us what the brain's doing, but it's giving us some idea of different patterns. And so if the brain goes down briefly and through stages of sleep into deep sleep and stays there for quite a while, and then it flips out into dreaming sleep, and you have a tiny little window of dreaming about an hour and a half into the night, and then the brain goes back down and repeats that cycle over and over through the night. So from light sleep down into deep sleep, back out into dreaming, and then over again. So we know what a normal sequence, normal in inverted commas, but typically what the brain would do on a good night, and that's how it operates. And so you can start to pick up, first of all, when the patient is waking up a lot. Obviously, all breathing related sleep disorders like sleep apnea, well, that's pretty clear. You've got some electrodes on the chest, you've got you're probably measuring you're measuring the breathing, and you can just tell if it stops. So there's those out the way. That's easy to spot if it happens. Insomnia, of course, you're very unlikely probably to go in and do a sleep test for insomnia because you're not going to sleep. You just told you. So that's sort of a separate thing, but for other things, then you're now getting into what is happening to the structure of sleep. So we're talking about sleep quality. This thing, this test can reveal sleep quality. And narcolepsy is very, very frequent dreaming. And that's what's pathological. Like, you fall asleep and you're instantly in dreaming sleep, which is not a state that would normally ever come until 90 minutes into the night. Where you dream, and then you get a fragment of proper sleep, and then you're dreaming again. So it's like being woken up, because your brain very clearly needs long consolidated stretches of this deep sleep. And people with narcolepsy rarely, really rarely get to that stage. So you're almost devoid of deep sleep. So that's what I started out with. It's like insomnia of a different kind. And then there's other sleep disorders. There's something called rapid eye movement behavior sleep disorder. So this is actually where you dream, and instead of being paralyzed, as would be sensible, so that you do not act out your dreams, another kind of neurodegeneration means that actually that paralysis doesn't kick in during dreaming, and you do act out your dreams, and that's phenomenally dangerous. So it's very violent thrashing around. There's periodic limb movement, which is very strange, but you, very regular intervals, muscle twitches or little movements that can be very disruptive to the structure of sleep. So these are the sorts of things you can pick up, and you can begin in that test to work out what might be damaging the integrity of sleep. The other test is special to narcolepsy. It's called the multiple sleep latency test. Is that right? MSLT, a multiple sleep latency test. And there the idea is you've woken up after your night in the lab. You have breakfast. It's all very nice, but you're still wired up. And then they, you know, half an hour, they say, all right, go back to sleep again. Now, for most people, that will be difficult. You're rested. You had a good night's sleep. You're not going to be able to. What do you mean? What do you mean go back to sleep? I'm not going to be able to go back to sleep. And they go out of the room. They switch the lights off, all that. You lie down. And most people would lie there for 20 minutes thinking, this is just silly. What am I doing? And that shows up. So if you don't have narcolepsy, you struggle to get back to sleep when told to. But for people with narcolepsy, you put them in a dark room at any time of the day and you tell them to do nothing, they will be asleep within, well, definitely within 5 minutes, more like within one. If I just try, if I put my head down, well, I can do it. So it's a sort of skill in certain situations, yeah. But... you do that multiple times. So then they come in 20 minutes later, they wake you up and they say, right, brilliant. And you, I don't know, watch a bit of TV for 10 minutes or half an hour or an hour. And they come in again and say, right, do that again. So you're supposed to do it 5 times. And if you fall asleep and go into, or if you fall asleep rapidly, but also key here is going into dreaming state, the rapid eye movement state, REM sleep, instantly. That's virtually that doesn't happen in normal brains. That's really characteristic of narcolepsy. So in these little mini enforced sleeps, if you see dreaming really in the space of 5 minutes, that's a bit of an indication it's probably narcolepsy. And then if you really wanted to confirm the diagnosis, you would take a bit of fluid out of the patient's spine, and you'd be looking for this hypocretin neurotransmitter, which would be in, you know, being made in those cells in the brain, and in most people, it's there. You've got appreciable amounts doing this stuff in your spine. It doesn't get into the bloodstream because of this thing called the blood-brain barrier. But you put a little tap into the spine, extract a bit of fluid. Most people have got hypocretin there. People with narcolepsy, virtually none or none. and that, so that's also sort of diagnostic.
The podcast you are now listening to is only a small portion of the value we offer our listeners. Go to sleeptohealthy.com and get thorough show notes, links to all the resources mentioned in the episode, all the other episodes, and much more. Visit sleeptohealthy.com to get the full benefit from each episode.
Doing the overnight sleep study and being hooked up to an EEG. Remember when I first learned about that, it struck me as a pretty kind of a crude measurement. I thought it was the equivalent of putting thousands of cell phones into a room, all of them on and interacting with each other, and then having some sort of a sensor on the other side of the wall and trying to make sense of what's happening in the cell phones. And one of the people you interviewed stated that the current definition of REM and non-REM sleep is simply inadequate. Can you explain that a bit?
Yeah, I like your analogy very much. And that's exactly how it is. These little pulses that we're getting, they tell us nothing about the real, what are those neurons deep inside doing? They don't tell you anything about that. So we've just got these patterns that divided sleep into different stages. This non-REM, which is sleep, as most people will know it, going down into deep sleep, and then a different category called REM, dreaming, which is when we do most of our dreaming. That doesn't tell us anything about what's happening inside the brain, so it is pretty inadequate. Rapid eye movement bit, and then the non-REM, and it makes it sound like non-REM is also not so significant. Non-REM is very, very important, and we know pretty much what's got really strong indications now, but only very recently, of what is happening neurologically in this state. But there was a huge focus on REM from the 1950s almost, because people were fascinated by dreams, and they wanted to know what the function of dreams was, what the meaning of dreams was. So REM is like the thing, and then there's non-REM, which nobody paid any attention to, but was probably a bit more important. And the REM is the rapid eye movement that those first researchers observed when people were dreaming, and the brain turned out to be in this state that we don't actually know what's going on inside it. But the eyes move, and they move rapidly. That doesn't happen in the other stages, non-REM. So it was sort of distinctive of REM. But, yeah, these definitions, I think your point is perfect. These definitions are superficial, and they tell us nothing. And so what we really want is, if you could really do it, you would be looking at the very heart of the brain, the bits that are actually controlling sleep, or which bits were on, or which neurons were doing what, and that's what you'd be interested in. I don't want to know whether I'm in REM or non-REM. I want to know whether my neurons are laying down memories right now, whether I'm rehearsing something that might make me perform it better the next day, whether cells are clearing out the debris of the day at this point in time. I want to know which bits of the brain are doing what when. And those superficial definitions of REM and non-REM tell us nothing about it. And the other thing, that researcher who was griping about this quite reasonably, he also has a real bone of contention with the whole idea of REM itself being defined as rapid eye movement. He works on fish. And they appear to have this same neurological state defined much more accurately by that paralysis that happens when we dream. So his fish, when they're sleeping, drifting around in the little lab water, they go through little moments of paralysis where their muscles relax, and you can see that. But they don't have eyelids, and they don't close their eyes, and their eyes don't move. So rapid eye movement sleep doesn't work as a definition, but neurologically they are doing it. It's exactly the same paralysis that's happening. So it's a peculiarly human-centric take on sleep. Lots of other animals do close their eyes, but sleep goes much, much further beyond just mammals, and a lot of them are doing, having this neurological state, but without what would be called, you couldn't see anything called rapid eye movement. So it's testimony really to the huge focus in the early days of sleep on the obsession with dreaming and the function of dreams, and on humans and sleep, and actually the way for us to uncover and work out the true functions of sleep or what's going on at the neurological level is to be able to get into brains. And you can't do that with humans, obviously. So animals are the way, animals and animal models like tiny little fish are the way that we begin to be able to see what the nerves do, what the neurons are doing differently when we sleep. And yeah, those functions that are happening in little fish, other vertebrates, not so distant evolutionarily from us, will also be happening in humans.
So it sounds like it's a combination that there's just an awful lot more to learn about sleep, and also that we're probably going to be stuck with, you know, from historical reasons, some terminology that over time will become more and more disconnected from the reality, and yet will probably stick with us, I suspect. So we're nearing the end of the interview here, and I have a fun but serious question for you. In my fantasy world, I'm a YouTube wizard who is giving you unlimited resources to produce a 30-second video. And in addition, my marketing wizards will guarantee a minimum of 10 million views of your video. So tell us what you would put in that video.
Wow. Now, for a moment, I was going to be selfish there and just say, right, I want to get the message about narcolepsy out there, because it's ignored. But then I think actually all sleep disorders are ignored, and they're so devastating, as people, I'm sure there'll be people listening now who are just going, yes, and they bear witness to that quite evident fact that most people just ignore, and society ignores, the true importance of quality sleep, and the flip side of that, the damage caused by dysfunctional sleep. And so I think an animation, how long would the YouTube clip, people don't watch YouTube for very long, could we in a really beautiful animation go into the brain, to these cells? I'm fascinated by these cells I don't have anymore. I would love to see them rendered in some beautiful way. And then briefly than I've been able to do today, to unpick the basic function of those neurons and then spread out to other sleep disorders, so that we see just the very many ways in which sleep can be damaged and how much care we need to be taking about our sleep. It's a curation project. You're like a curator looking after this very, very precious object, and you need to be doing everything you can to conserve it and protect it all the time. You know, it's like someone in a natural history museum looking after this really priceless object. They've got to keep the humidity right, the temperature right. So there's about a dozen really important things that we need to be juggling to get sleep into that absolute zone that my wife can achieve and that I have every night and I have impossible envy of. Some people can just do this and they take it for granted, and that's great. But a lot of people are going to need to work at that for loads of reasons. You know, life is complicated, and one of the first things to get smashed up and affected is sleep. So identifying where we go wrong, and I think so a nice little video that really got to the heart of sleep and then pulled out to show, I don't want to frighten people with the story of how devastating life is with no sleep, because it is pretty bad, but it's an uplifting story really when you can identify those things and then do something about it. So, you know, my memory is awful. I forgot something quite important today that I need to apologize for tomorrow. I said I'd do at the beginning of the day and then just totally forgot at 3 o'clock. I was supposed to be doing the register for some 11-year-olds, like taking PM registration. I just didn't go because I just forgot. I just don't actually know who did, but it will have caused something for someone else. These sorts of things. People living with all this stuff. But then when you start to identify things you can actually do, and then really see those improvements, it is instead of being a negative thing, it's quite uplifting. And, well, it's just super empowering.
Yeah, I like the visualization you started that video off with. It reminded me some of the descriptions that you had in the book of kind of what's going on in the inner workings of the brain. So as we wrap up here, where should people go to learn more about you and the resources you have available?
Well, I have a website, henrynichols.com. So there is more information there. And I'm on Twitter at Way of the Panda, which was one of my other books, and I never changed my handle. But yeah, the book, you know, if people want to read it, I promise you, it's not a bad starting place for really trying to understand the breadth. There are a lot of good sleep books out there, but hopefully an entertaining sort of journey through all the different sleep disorders, all the big ones, and why sleep is so important.
Okay, and as always, we will have the links to Mr. Nichols' website, Twitter, Facebook, and book in the show notes at sleeptohealthy.com. Henry, this conversation has only brushed the surface, really, of your book. There were two things that impressed me as I read the book that I thought were quite unique about Sleepyhead. And the first was that you researched into not just the science, but into the backstory of the science and how the backstory of some of the characters and how that science actually came to be, I guess, not just in the scientific findings. And the second is how you don't treat disorders in isolation, but you draw some sometimes very surprising connections between seemingly unrelated conditions. So I would especially recommend the book to anyone that wants a deeper and up-to-date understanding of sleep research. So on behalf of our listeners, thank you for making it a priority to be with us today and giving some rare insights into the conditions of narcolepsy and also the related sleep disorders.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Let's summarize some of the key points Mr. Nicholas made today. The first is the interconnectedness of sleep disorders. The brain is a mess of 100 billion neurons, each with about 1,000 connections with fellow neurons. That's a huge mess of interconnectivity. It shouldn't surprise us, then, that sleep disorders don't occur in isolation. So, if you have a sleep disorder, don't label yourself and restrict yourself to that sleep disorder. Look for blurry lines and be prepared to address those symptoms under your control, regardless of whether they fit your predefined box or not. The second is that sleep disorders can take a long time to properly diagnose. Be your own best advocate and be prepared to be persistent and assertive. Consider using a sleep app or recordings as evidence to take to your doctor to back your claims. The third is that warning to those who may have sleep apnea. This is serious stuff that needs your attention, so if you suspect this condition, get it checked out, please. As always, you can find detailed show notes about the interview with Mr. Nicholas, along with links at sleeptohealthy.com. And this concludes our episode for today. Michael Schwartz, certified clinical sleep educator, is our next guest, where you will learn about a $10 sleep app that mimics a multi-thousand-dollar trip to the sleep lab. And no, this is not yet another sleep monitoring app, but one that performs intensive sleep retraining. I tell about my experience with the app and post my results. And thank you if you have sent in comments or suggestions, and for telling your friends about the podcast. Your input and support help give me the motivation to keep this labor of love going. Thank you for keeping me company today, and I look forward to you joining me on the next episode of the Sleep to Healthy podcast. This podcast is not a substitute for advice from a qualified healthcare professional. The sole purpose of this podcast is to educate and entertain. As we do not know your particulars, we cannot and do not provide professional or medical advice or services. We strongly encourage you to consult a healthcare professional before incorporating any ideas in this podcast. Listeners who use the information in this podcast do so at their own risk. The guests on this podcast express their own opinions, beliefs, and conclusions, which is neither supported nor opposed by the podcast and host. The podcast does not fact check information provided.